there are anti-democratic elements in our constitutional system that this administration has very adeptly exploited and has put out these test balloons, as I've said, with universities and law firms. And what they're about to do next, I think we all have to be very worried about.
And we're going to continue.
As we saw the Berlin Wall.
We're going to continue this discussion and post online at democracynow.org. Catherine Franke, former professor at Columbia Law School, as she puts it, the university retired her. To see our conversations with her in the past, go to democracynow.org. And to see our new conversation with her, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to 90.3 KFAI FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, online and archived at kfai.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to Mini Culture Presents. I'm Michael Whetstone and thanks for joining me for today's program. Mini Culture celebrates women pioneers. We're going to hear three stories from three Mini Culture producers about great women in Minnesota history. In the second half of the show, Joe Fredericks tells us about Indigenous women in the fur trade and how that tradition carries on still today. And lastly, we'll hear a brand new story from producer Allison Young about a weather girl turned weather reporter. But first, we are going to visit the Mini Culture Vault and pull out this piece produced in 2014 by frequent Mini Culture contributor and our resident historian, Britt Ahmet. Britt examines one of the most significant heroes in Minnesota women's history, Rosalie Wall, Minnesota's first female Supreme Court justice.
Rapidly aging, please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand, cause the times, they are a-changing.
The 1960s were a decade of enormous social ferment and change.
We shall overcome.
African Americans marched on Washington and saw civil rights legislation enacted into law after a century had passed since Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. Indignation over the war in Vietnam and the intrinsic unfairness of the draft erupted on college campuses and on the airwaves. Women got on the pill. They stopped wearing bras and smoked dope at Woodstock. But as the 70s dawned, women were beginning to feel that the tide of social empowerment had left them high and dry. In 1970, Minnesota was in lockstep with the nation. Though women made up an ever larger proportion of the workforce, they still earned 59 cents to the man's dollar. If a woman applied for a credit card or a mortgage, too often she'd be asked to have a male co-signer. Women had the growing sense that if the fair sex were ever to get a fair shake in America, then they'd have to change the institutions that govern their lives and their bodies, and do it by becoming members of those institutions at the very highest level. In Minnesota, a target for the women's movement was the state Supreme Court, which had never seen a woman sit on the bench. When a seat opened in 1977, however, the opportunity had arrived, and two very unlikely figures, Rudy Perpich, Minnesota's Catholic pro-life governor, and Rosalie Wall, a public defender, mother of five, a Quaker, and poet, would come together to change the face of Minnesota's justice system. When Perpich, against the odds and in the teeth of opposition, appointed Wall to that high bench.
Amazing grace. I never saw a woman judge. I never had a chance to practice in front of one.
In 2014, the Minnesota Historical Society Press published Her Honor, Rosalie Wall and the Minnesota Women's Movement. Author Lori Sturtevant first encountered Justice Wall in the 1970s when Sturtevant was beginning a career in journalism.
I come to Minnesota in 1974 to go to graduate school in journalism. I'm hired by the Minneapolis Tribune in 1975 and start almost immediately covering the women's movement. I was asked to cover religion, and in those years covering religion meant covering the abortion movement, and that was a straight shot directly into state politics.
A child of the baby boom, Sturtevant grew up in a world that wanted to hold on to the way things had always been done, but whose status quo people like her father were already starting to challenge.
My dad ran for school board in my little town in South Dakota in the mid-1960s, and he lost his one and only campaign for elective office. And his position was that female teachers should be paid the same as men, regardless of what their husbands did. And that was a losing position in that little town in about 1965 or 66. That's what I remember about how it was. So that sort of attitude begins to be called into question and changes. It happened very quickly. So in Minnesota in 1972, we began to elect women in bigger numbers to the legislature. And while we only went from 1 to 6 out of a total of 201 legislators, that was seen as earth-shattering for the men who were in charge. In 1973, the ERA is ratified in Minnesota. In 1973, at the same time that is happening, we have the Roe versus Wade decision handed down. And almost immediately in Minnesota, a backlash develops that's pretty intense. Doors were closed, and suddenly they opened, not just in a few parts of society, but in lots of them. But it happened in so many places so rapidly all at once that it has to have been more than just the influence of one or two strong leaders. This movement was in part the coming of age of the baby boomers. It was the realization that family life was changing, that the pill had arrived, and women were able to control reproduction better than they ever had before. Economically, women had reached a big enough critical mass in the workforce that business began to realize we can't do without them. So there's a great impetus for women to be in the workforce. And so in Minnesota, we suddenly have a push for women to run for office, elective office, in lots of ways, and push for women to be involved in careers that had been previously closed to them. And it manifests itself in the Minnesota legislature, with the legislature going from one female member, one out of 201 in the 1971 session, to 6 in the Minnesota House in 1973. That was the breakthrough year. And then steady increases in each succeeding election going through the 1970s.
Come life, shake your life, come life, eternal, shake out of me, all that is
fine. The thing I think about justice is that if there's injustice out there anywhere, then justice for everybody is in danger.
Rosalie Wall was born Sarah Rosalie Irwin on August 27, 1924, in Gordon, Kansas. Her early life would be marked by tragedy. Less than 4 years after her birth, her mother died, and the 4 Irwin children were separated. Rosalie and her younger brother went to live with their grandparents, Effie and Harry Patterson, who farmed 160 acres near the Oklahoma border. And it was here that the incident that would create another unbreachable void in the young girl's life would take place. The same incident, however, that would fire Rosalie's lifelong desire to make her life matter.
She was witness to the accident that killed her younger brother and her grandfather when she was 7 years old. It was a train accident.
Lori Sturtevant.
It was the springtime of the year, and it was a typical farm chore to take a buckboard wagon with a horse and to go across a railroad track into a wooded area to collect some wood. And that she and her little brother were with Grandpa on that errand. Rosalie jumped down from the buckboard to go open a gate, and there were actually 2 gates, one on each side of the railroad track. She got the first gate open, ran across the track to open the second one. There was a curve so that the approach of any train was hidden, but there were no trains scheduled at that hour of the day, so the family had no reason to expect that any train would be coming. But just that quick, here came a speeding train trying to make up lost time. When a train approaches a crossing like that, it's supposed to sound its horn well in advance. It did not. So there was no warning. It was just all of a sudden a speeding train barreling down on this buckboard. Grandpa tries to throw the little boy away, but the little boy is caught in the cow catcher of the train. Grandpa is struck by the fast-moving train. Rosalie was witness to this horrible accident. That was a moment of great change for that family. Grandpa was young enough to have still two teenage boys at home, but they soon left. Grandma, who had been a busy farm wife with a fairly good-sized farm, that farm was lost. She wound up moving into an old house with no plumbing and electricity. That was, the family tried to make as cozy as they could, and that was where Rosalie spent the rest of her childhood. There was another tragedy that came about to Rosalie, too. In her senior year in high school, she became acquainted with a fellow named Peck. She fell in love, and it was 1942. Her fiancé was called into the military. They planned to be married, and he was injured in a flight training accident. He was in the Army Air Corps. Injured in a flight training accident, she races to his bedside but doesn't make it in time, and he has died just an hour before she arrives. So her life experienced quite a few trauma, incidents of loss, but within a few months, was a woman of great spirit. She rallied her thinking to think, no, I have to make a difference. Life is fragile and short, and what time I have to use wisely for the benefit of other people.
4 years after Rosalie's birth, the man who would play a large role in furthering her destiny to serve was born on Minnesota's Iron Range. Rudy Perpich was the son of a Croatian miner and of a mother who wanted a better life for her children.
He was unique in many ways.
Retired Star Tribune reporter Betty Wilson was a longtime member of the Capitol Press Corps and through Noden Press published the biography of Perpich, Rudy, the People's Governor, in 2005.
For one thing, he did so much for women. He had the first woman lieutenant governor, Marlene Johnson, and that was just a shocker to many people. He was a very decent person. He was the first governor we had from the Iron Range. He was the first Roman Catholic governor we had. He came from very modest background, of course. His parents were very poor. His father worked in the iron mines, and he was out of work a lot of the time. His mother, her father, had died in a mining accident when she was, I think, barely a teenager. I think she was in the eighth grade, or just about then. And she had to quit school and go to work helping her mother run a boarding house, I think it was. And she always felt bad that she hadn't been able to finish school. She was determined that her sons would get a good education. So when the boys came home from school, first they had to do the chores outside, get wood in, milk the cow, whatever. Then they had to do their homework, and they did their homework on the kitchen floor because they only had three rooms. And at that time, the three boys all slept together in one bed. Well, one of the things he always said was that education was his passport out of poverty. One of the things that I remember his saying, where he got his concern for women, he worked for a grocer when he was a kid, doing bags and deliveries and stuff. And he went to houses where he saw women who had been abused by their husbands, and women just deprived of everything almost, and just such sad cases, that he took those experiences with him first to the school board. Then when he became a state senator and then a governor.
Lori Sturdivant.
I would say certainly family was extremely important to her. Words mattered to her. She was a poet. And she wrote very spare poetry that had really a strong emotional impact. Music mattered to her. She was a singer who loved to sing in a cappella choirs and was a founder of an a cappella singing group called the Nightingales through the Friends. The Society of Friends, the Quakers, mattered to her. She was much drawn by this sort of dual nature of the Quaker practice and faith. The Quakers were people who worshipped quietly, but then also would break forth from that into pronouncements about social justice and social activism, and would do things like create intentional communities, do things like go stand and hold protest signs before the Iraq War, which Rosalie did when, in retirement, she was among those peace protesters down by the Lake Street Bridge.
The metamorphosis of Rosalie Wall from homemaker and mother to Minnesota's first female Supreme Court justice didn't happen overnight.
No, it wasn't. I always wanted to be a lawyer. It was I always wanted to be of service to other people.
In fact, through the 1950s and into the early 60s, she was more concerned with getting the kids off to school, planning meals in the household budget, and figuring out how to deal with the erratic mood swings of her husband, a veteran of World War II, most likely suffering from PTSD. The idea of becoming a transformative agent of gender equality and a role model for the women's movement was far down Rosalie's list, if it was there at all. In Sturtevant's History of the Period, Her Honor, Rosalie Wall, and the Minnesota Women's Movement, the author describes an otherwise prosaic scene in Rosalie's life. When she went to the Washington Library Board to send the bookmobile to her rural end of the county, the library board, all men, met in their conference room, and without ever consulting Rosalie or the other petitioning mothers, decided against the proposal.
It was after that I decided to go to law school. I was tired of sitting outside of doors with the doors shut and them deciding.
Rosalie saw then that the law could have been used on the side of helping people. She, of course, remembered the incident of her childhood when the law could have been used to bring some justice to her family after the train accident, and there was no help there. She saw an opportunity through getting to know a few other female lawyers, the very few that there were, that there was an option for women who were bookish and enjoyed study and enjoyed the language, enjoyed writing, as Rosalie did, all those things. There was an opportunity there. So she plunged ahead, not so much sure what kind of lawyer she wanted to be, but sure that the law could be a tool for social justice and for good. Well, she was one of two women in her class at William Mitchell College of Law, just two. And the other woman was a good deal younger. But at that point, to be a lawyer was to be a man. And the explosion of women in law schools happens a good decade or so after Rosalie's time in law school. And by the time, that time, actually, Rosalie is a professor at William Mitchell and is able to be an instructor as this wave starts to come. It takes the baby boom generation reaching that age for that explosion to come. The baby boom generation is our best educated generation in American history. So we have a big surge that Rosalie's not part of. That happened a good 10, 12 years after her time in law school. She doesn't have any particularly tough stories to tell about mistreatment, certainly not by her fellow students. Her contemporary on the court was Esther Tomjanovich, who's a little younger than Rosalie and happens to be was her neighbor in Lake Elmo. That was just a coincidence. And Esther had been to law school a few years before Rosalie. And Esther always said that the men in law school classes treated me as their pet. I could be the class pet because they knew I would never be a threat to their careers. They knew I wouldn't maybe even get an interview at the big firms. And indeed, that was Esther's experience. Esther wound up going to work for the government.
Rosalie finished her law degree while also giving birth to and taking care of a fifth child. Her first job was as a public defender in the state's newly formed public defender's office. In those days, appeals were heard before the Supreme Court. So immediately, she found herself arguing cases before the highest court in the state.
I felt as if I'd been thrown off a horse.
That trial by fire along with Rosalie's tenure as a law professor, was all preparation for a future only dimly realized when she received a questionnaire in the mail from a Minnesota Women's Lawyers Association asking if she'd ever consider a position on the bench. The question got her thinking.
Would I be willing to be a judge?
In 1976, Rudy Perpich became governor. Less than a year later, a seat on the Supreme Court opened up, and the DFL governor started making noises that maybe he'd like to appoint a woman.
The women who were really pushing to get a woman on the court, first woman on the court, they weren't taking any chances.
Perpich biographer Betty Wilson.
And Gwen Jones Spitz, who was a copy editor at the Strib, had a lot to do with her being appointed Supreme Court Justice. Because Gwen was a reporter for the courts. She wrote a story about Perpich promising that his next appointment to the Supreme Court would be a woman. So Gwen made sure that she got that story printed so she'd have him on record, because Perpich was known to change his mind sometimes depending on the last person he'd talked to. So Gwen got it on record. Okay, he's going to appoint a woman.
He was very openly saying, I want to appoint a woman and I want a process to take place. And so it was like almost like a beauty contest, and then people could write in and express their opinion. One of Rosalie's former law school students got busy and got together a letter-writing campaign on her behalf. And the postcards and letters just flooded the governor's office. Anyway, Rosalie is one of a few candidates to be called in for an interview, and Perpich's rule of thumb about interviewing candidates for any high position, as he would meet them for the first time and listen to them talk, he would ask himself, can I hug this person? He always talked about this. I heard him say it, and others who've been around him say the same thing. He would sit there and think, can I hug this person? And Rosalie struck him as huggable. And in many others, I think she also said kind of the right words about looking out for the underdog. She believed that fervently. So did Perpich. They were really sympathetic in that respect. Really, the word I'm looking for is simpatico. They were really thinking alike about what justice required. So I think it was a happy connection. And he appoints her to much acclaim. He puts the robe on her and is present for her swearing in October of 77.
In only 15 years, Rosalie Wall went from concerned citizen to law student to Minnesota Supreme Court Justice. The women's movement celebrated a victory that would have seemed impossible even 5 years before.
There were men who were in the queue thinking that the next Supreme Court appointment should be theirs who were offended by Perpich's expansion of the pool to include all these women. And the fact that Perpich made a point not even to consider a man for that appointment. So one of them, Bob Mattson, the former attorney general of the state, went so far as to go to Perpich and tell him personally that if he appointed a woman, he'd run against that person in the next election.
Because of the timing of Rosalie's appointment, she had to stand for re-election the next year. Now the question of whether a woman could fill a judge's robes was not at the discretion of a progressive governor, but in the hands of the public. Former Attorney General Mattson and two district judges, all male, all with significant war chests, ran against her in the primary.
So these were substantial men with serious political credentials, and a vigorous campaign ensues with the men very brazenly saying, Rosalie isn't qualified and should not be on this court. They didn't say a woman shouldn't be on the court. They weren't that foolish. But the way they would describe her credentials would certainly give comfort to any voter who thought that a woman shouldn't be on the court. And it was probably because there were three of them and not two that Rosalie was able to get through that primary as one of two victors, because then the anti-female vote got divided three ways. That was a good thing. Mattson went forward, and Mattson at that point overreaches and begins to literally lie about Rosalie's record in ways that cause every editorial writer in the state practically to come down on his head, that rally the establishment legal community behind Rosalie. And Rosalie then is able to win that election with surprising ease. Nobody expected her to win as easily as she did. The fact that she campaigned hard for it, and the fact that the women's movement was coming into its own and was able to rally significant support for her, able to raise significant money for her. She always said for the rest of her days, I would not be here without the women's movement. Both the women's, she thought that the women's movement helped Purpich decide to appoint her. I've heard the story enough times to think that Purpich might have done that without being pushed, though he was pushed. I think he might have done the right thing in 1977 without that push.
Rosalie Wall would go on to serve as a Supreme Court Justice until her retirement in 1994. She died in 2013. Rudy Purpich died in 1995 and, says biographer Betty Wilson, left a significant legacy.
Maybe if you had to point the most important thing Purpich did that really made a big change was what he did for women.
Many female justices on the Supreme Court and the Appeals Court followed in Rosalie's wake. But why was it important to have a woman on the bench in the first place? Rosalie liked to give the analogy of binoculars. With both women and men on the bench, you were seeing with both eyes. During her tenure, Rosalie broadened the court's view of justice, or perhaps just redirected it, by carrying the ball in the establishment of task forces that looked into gender and racial bias in the state's justice system. But her influence extended to a personal level as well, says biographer Lori Sturdivant.
It was important for the sake of a role model for women to look at this court and see people who looked like them and see opportunities, pathways for them to move forward in their own careers, be it in the law or some other profession, to have that role model set before them. A good deal of time after the 1978 election, about 1982 or so, a mother of a teenage daughter in St. Paul came up to Rosalie and said that Rosalie's photo from a newspaper clipping had been clipped to the wall of their home ever since that 1978 campaign. And the daughter had the habit of touching it as she went out the door in the morning as an acknowledgement, look, women can do this. Women can succeed. I can do this too. I don't think any other Supreme Court justice in Minnesota history had that kind of impact on people, an inspirational impact on young people. I don't think that many others were so visibly allied with the underdog as Rosalie was, and with a desire to make the court system work well for everybody.
You can bend but never break me, 'cause it only serves to make me more determined to achieve my final goal. And I come back even stronger.
This is Brit Omit for KFAI, where Miniculture is brought to you by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
That was the story Rosalie Wall, Minnesota's first Supreme Court Justice, produced by Britt Omit for Miniculture back in 2014. Support for Miniculture is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Support for this program comes from KFAI listener members just like you and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And we'll return to our program, Miniculture Celebrates Women Pioneers, right after these messages.
KFAI is supported by Mutual Management Company. Mutual Management Company provides tailor quality housing services. Areas of expertise include managing affordable housing with a personalized focus on strengthening the community. Mutual Management serves an assorted portfolio of renters and owners of scattered site and single site residential and commercial developments designed to preserve and protect real people with a real property in the Twin Cities. Find out more by calling 612-333-9164 and online at mutualmanagementcompany.com.
Thursday, April 3rd, KFAI brings you the Toast of Paris as Caravan Palace returns to the First Avenue main room for an electric one-night-only show. The electro swing sensation that combines Django Reinhardt with Daft Punk is ready to bring the house down with their infectious jazzy electronic beats. With an undeniable string of hits, Caravan Palace returns with their latest release, Gangster Melody Club. Opening the show is Zayka. Tickets for Caravan Palace can be found at the First Avenue website. Visit first-avenue.com for more details.
You are listening to KFAI Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, supported by generous listener members just like you and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is Mini Culture Presents here on KFAI on Monday afternoons. My name is Michael Whetstone. Today we're listening to three stories in an episode we're calling Mini Culture Celebrates Women Pioneers. Our next story is a near literal example of women pioneers, the role of women, particularly indigenous women. KFAI contributor Joe Fredericks travels to Grand Portage and the Boundary Waters region to tell the story of the women of the fur trade. Here's Joe.
In the pale light of an unfinished basement, Laura Powell Markson surveys a desktop of rabbit, beaver, bobcats, and other furs that are spread across a cluttered desktop. Laura surveys the scene before carefully picking up a pair of half-finished mittens. She looks at the mittens and then slowly glances around the room, knowing this will be her next project. It's here, in this space, where animals trapped from the border lakes of Minnesota and Ontario transform into hats, moccasins, and other apparel.
Everything that we create down here has a spirit. This piece, which will eventually be that hat, has a spirit by nature of the fact that this was an animal that died to keep someone warm.
Laura has been trapping for most of her life. She grew up on a massive lake at the end of the Gunflint Trail. The lake, known as Saginaw, or Sag, to most people who are familiar with the area, is the largest and deepest lake in the Boundary Waters. Now 43, Laura lives in what she calls the city of Grand Marais. A small community on the edge of Lake Superior has a population of about 1,300 people. The house where she works sits on the hillside overlooking downtown. There's a direct view of the Grand Marais Harbor from her front porch. In the summer, she watches commercial fishermen head out to the vast expanse of Superior each morning. In the winter, she can hear ice forming in the harbor. And while her main floor offers a direct view of Lake Superior, Laura prefers to work in the dark confines of the home's basement.
I feel very at home here. This is very unfinished basement. I could go upstairs and work, but down here is just a proper fit. It's where I got started.
Laura grew up some 60 miles from Grand Marais on the Canadian side of Sag. Trapping animals for their fur was a way of life for Laura and her family. The furs were sold at auctions across the United States and in Canada. In that sense, Laura's first job was not typical. She wasn't a server in a cafe. She wasn't a lifeguard at the local pool. Laura's first job was being a trapper in the North Woods.
It was awesome. I had a very unconventional life, and we did without some things. I mean, we didn't have running water, we didn't have electricity, of course, no TVs, so it was a very hands-on. You know, I think I've been born 100 years too late. This world moves too fast for me.
Laura and her twin sister Paula spent countless hours of their youth hunting, fishing, and trapping in northern Minnesota and across the border in Ontario. The skills she learned in the woods are generational, including from her great-grandmother, Mary Ottertail, an Ojibwe woman from the Lac La Croix First Nation, and her great-grandfather, Jack Powell. Mary Ottertail, as the family stories go, taught her husband Jack everything there was to know about life in the North Woods. One thing she taught him was how to be a trapper, says Laura's father, Dickie Powell.
They trapped and they lived basically off the land. And you know, it's just the way they done things. When you look at it, it was a very kind of a tough life in a way, but really it wasn't.
What it was, Dick and Laura both explained, was a simple life. Generations removed from the peak of the fur trade, many of the principles that guided the era remain intact for Laura and Paula. The practice of trapping means direct connection to the land and animals of a particular place, Laura says. It means hard work, cold mornings, and an understanding of the value of life and death. For generations, this has been a way of life for people who call this region their home, including families who lived here during the legendary fur trade. In the most basic sense, what's commonly referred to as the fur trade was a period of cultural and economic exchange between Native Americans and European Americans, according to the Minnesota Historical Society. Native Americans traded along the waterways of the Boundary Waters and across the Great Lakes for centuries before the arrival of Europeans in the mid-1600s. For nearly 200 years afterward, European American traders exchanged manufactured goods with Native people for valuable furs. As the pages of history were put down, one aspect that was continually overlooked is the role women played at home, in the woods, and throughout many aspects of life during the fur trade. The simple truth is that women actively contributed to the success of the North American fur trade, according to Carl Koster, a historian who specializes in the history of the fur trade.
And here's this huge international company, right? We're selling furs at the Leipzig Fair in Germany. We got furs being sold in London. We're bringing in things to trade from Germany, France, Italy, Spain, South America, Africa, and Asia. So we have this huge multi-million dollar company here, the Northwest Company. Bunch of rich millionaire Montreal guys putting money in. So it's the oil companies, the auto industry of today. This huge thing. Here it is in the 1780s and 1790s, and look at what they're doing to make this operate. What they are doing sometimes is they are going into Native villages and they are asking permission to build trading posts. And these negotiations quite often involve women. We have a quote of hiring Native women guides, literally hiring Native women because they've traveled to visit family. They know where things are. The Europeans don't know where things are west of here. So we have to hire Native women to take a bunch of French Canadians and English and Scots, a bunch of Caucasian white guys, into the interior, show them where they're going.
Koster has worked at the Grand Portage National Monument for more than two decades. A federally funded monument preserves the legacy of the fur trade activity and Ojibwe heritage. I visited the monument on a cold winter morning in February to talk with Koster. Waves were crashing on the shoreline of Lake Superior as I drove toward the Canadian border. Though many of the bays were frozen when I arrived in Grand Portage, including the large bay directly in front of the monument. Shortly after I arrived, I walked up a winding staircase to Koster's office. We spent time talking about the actual Grand Portage, which was a path that was part of the historic trade route of the French-Canadian voyageurs used between their wintering grounds and their trading grounds to the east, including at Lake Superior. Composed of the Pigeon River and all manner of streams, lakes, and portages, this route was of enormous importance during the fur trade. It provided quick water access from Canada's settled areas and what is now the Boundary Waters and Atlantic ports, Koster says. In terms of common knowledge, much of the fur trade lore focuses on sturdy voyageurs and bearded white men paddling canoes. However, there's much more to the era's history. Koster says that whether at forts or on the trade route or serving as guides for white trappers, Women were active and essential participants in many fur trade operations. For example, Native women often took on the role of a liaison between the French trappers and other tribes along the trade route. Payment was involved, and in many ways, the women held positions of authority over the white trappers, Koster says.
I mean, here's this multi-million dollar company hiring Native women, putting them in charge of white guys. Where do you see... This is 1790. Where in 1890 do you find multi-million dollar companies hiring minority women and putting them in positions of power over white people?
We're in 1990.
We're in 1990. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
The area in what is now the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness and Quetico Provincial Park was a main thoroughfare for trapping during the fur trade. In the way many motorists use Interstate 35 to travel from the Twin Cities to the Boundary Waters these days, on a much smaller scale, that was how popular the border lakes were for fur traders during the peak of the fur trade. And while many might think of bearded French voyageurs traveling to the interior in search of pelts, the role of indigenous women is paramount in the success of the fur trade, Koster says. From the eastern side of the Great Lakes to the land now commonly referred to as the Boundary Waters, Native women did everything from guiding to making snowshoes that would be used by trappers as they navigated the forests and frozen lakes each winter. Lee Johnson is a Superior National Forest archaeologist who works for the U.S. Forest Service. He says from about the 1690s to the 1890s, a span that embodies the peak of the fur trade in the Boundary Waters region, Native women were essential in what he describes as provisioning trade.
So you had like the formal trade that went on in all these big depots like Grand Portage and Rainy Lake and up into the, you know, Athabascan country. These depots were like formal trade occurred, but all along those canoe routes, there was provisioning trade that occurred as the canoe brigades were coming by. And that's, you know, that's what really kept the trade going, was this provisioning trade for like products like wild rice and smoked whitefish and dried, you know, dried venison, dried moose. Even like the pitch, the gum for repairing canoes and the provisioning trade that occurred along the way, women were at the, you know, the forefront of that type of trade.
Johnson says provisioning trade, largely orchestrated by Native women, was essential to keep trappers moving and their energy high during the fur trade.
That wild rice, that the fish, you know, the repair items to repair canoes. You know, from my reading and talking with elders and reading even into the, you know, the ethnographic and ethnohistorical accounts of Ojibwe folks, like that was critical to the fur trade and to early settlers here on the North Shore.
In other words, Johnson says the role of Native women, both during the fur trade and during the early settlement of the North Shore near what is now Grand Marais, was crucial.
It was this blending, this absolute blending of cultures and technology and knowledge, and the trade good is just all assuming. It's much more complex than we would have believed from some of the literature that we read early on.
An embodiment of this blending of cultures was personified by numerous individuals throughout the generations, including John Linkletter, who lived in what is now the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness on Basswood Lake for many years. Linkletter is of Anishinaabe, Cree, and Scottish ancestry. He worked as a guide, a trapper, and eventually as a state employee tracking other trappers who violated the law. Tim Cochran is a historian and author who lives near Grand Marais. He published a book in the winter of 2023 titled Making the Carry, The Lives of John and Cheekywis Linkletter. The book shares the story of Linkletter and his wife, Cheekywis, of the Lac La Croix First Nation. The couple lived most of their adult life from about the 1870s until the 1930s on Basswood Lake. As Cochran explains, the Linkletters lived through the introduction of logging and mining in northern Minnesota. They witnessed firsthand the arrival of white people, first as waves of trappers along the border lakes, and then later when industry rolled in, forever changing the landscape.
At this time, they lived through just about every kind of change imaginable.
the first treaties, the first reservations, the first Indian agents, the first miners, the first railroad people, and the Quetico, the first soldiers going through for the Dawson Trail, and then farms and the immigration largely in the in their part of close to Winton of mostly Finnish Americans, and the growth of these towns, all these things, that all happened in their lifetime.
Cochran and I discussed the link letters one afternoon while walking near Lake Superior and Superior National Forest.
Probably that's forest, you know. God, it's a nice day, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's probably the nicest day of the year.
It is so far. Well, let's go over in there.
It was a cold but sunny winter day in northeastern Minnesota, similar to many days that Cheekywiss would have lived through on the edge of the Boundary Waters. Cochran says Cheekywiss was, in many ways, the embodiment of the indigenous women who lived in this part of the world, both before, during, and after the fur trade. John Linkletter, meanwhile, who also went by Jack, knew his way around Isle Royale, most of Superior National Forest, and what is now Quetico Provincial Park in Ontario. He worked as a trapper and fur dealer at various times in his life. Cochran says that Jack could navigate the local woods and waters, while Cheekywiss was celebrated for her skill in beadwork and weaving.
She made these remarkable moose calls that are made out of birch bark, and they have geometric figures, sometimes beaded, sometimes not. She was always tanning moose hides, and she would always be making moccasins and always giving away moccasins. She made these remarkable geometric mats that the largest one is about 4.5 feet by 8 feet. And they're woven with the inner bark of white cedar and dyed. And they were once called an Ojibwa linoleum because they were used as the floor coverings when they were still in temporary wigwams and birch bark wigwams, and then they'd move so they could roll these babies up. That art died out in the 1920s, but she went on to sell these things to wealthy white people. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them persist today.
Cochran points out that Cheekywiss also had a connection to Laura Powell and her family from Saginaw Lake at the end of the Gunflint Trail. Cheekywiss and Mary Ottertail, who was Laura Powell's great-grandmother, were first cousins. The current methods used to trap beaver, fisher, and other animals near Saginaw Lake were used by Mary Ottertail and the Linkletters for decades before Laura Powell ever laid eyes on the Boundary Waters. Lake Saginaw is a massive body of water at the end of the Gunflint Trail. It's a paved roadway that winds its way from Lake Superior along the edge of Minnesota's Boundary Waters. The end of the Gunflint is a remote place, with Grand Marais being the nearest town. Laura and Paula Powell's parents, Dick and Sherry, taught the twins how to survive in this beautiful but remote and often harsh landscape. Sherry came from Chicago and had to learn this for herself before the twins were born. Sherry left the city life because it was too busy and there was minimal connection to the natural world. Life at the end of the Gunflint Trail was the opposite of Chicago in many ways. There was hunting and fishing, long days working outside. It was all here. As was trapping. Running trap lines, Sherry says, was something she enjoyed, even though it wasn't easy.
For me, it was an excuse to get out in the woods, and that's what I really wanted to do, was get out in the woods. But the more I learned, I just didn't have the hand strength to set traps, so it was always him and I. And especially like great big con bears, like the beaver traps, I've never been able to do that. I used to be able to set the little leg hold traps, but then they became, you couldn't use them anymore, and so I was kind of out of it, you know. But we did that together.
Laura says that people have told her throughout her life that her connection to trapping, furs, beading, and other practices comes from her ancestors, including Mary Ottertail. Throughout her life, Laura says that her parents were very supportive of her being a young trapper growing up in the woods of Minnesota and Ontario, but they never forced her to participate in the activity.
There's not very many people that do this kind of stuff. If you go into Canada, there's much more people, First Nations people, that do this. But down here, there's just not. And my parents were the type of people who always had time. They took the time. If we came to them and had a question or, you know, whatever it was. And I feel that I was lucky to have people like that in my life.
Trapping for Mary Ottertail and the Link Letters was a way of life. It was essential for their survival during the long winters of the North, and for economic reasons. For Laura Powell, trapping was something she grew up with, embraced, celebrated, and ultimately gets to share with her community. The hats, gloves, and other items she makes from fur are natural treasures from the forests of her childhood, she explains. Though she's also aware these gifts are not for everyone.
This is what people don't understand. They say, okay, well, they've got these campaigns, trapping is bad, trapping is cruel. On the other hand, you have people like First Nations people throughout Canada. If trapping was no longer a thing that they couldn't do, not only their livelihood and their culture would be gone, but to some people there, that's their job. That's what they do. And people don't understand that. I really try very hard to work with stuff that isn't farmed because it's just not right. As somebody that grew up on the trap line, it's just not right. And that is cruel. So I can sit here and tell you, I love animals. Clearly you can see that. But I also utilize them the way that they were meant to be. The moose to the Ojibwe people is what the buffalo is to the Lakota people. Animals were here before us. They didn't need us, but we need them. And so people say, well, it's 2023. You could be using fake fur. Well, yeah, I could, but then I would be a fraud because I will not wear fake fur.
Back in the basement of her home in Grand Marais, Laura explains that these days she gets most of her fur from a fur dealer in Hovland, another small community on Minnesota's rugged North Shore. Other furs come in from a tannery in Maine. Laura says there's not much profit for local trappers like herself in Cook County and near the Boundary Waters these days, but it's still something she enjoys. If she could, she'd spend her time in the woods living a quiet life, one very similar to that of her great-grandmother, Mary Ottertail.
I have felt her here in ways that surprise me. I'd be doing something, measuring something here, and all of a sudden I just feel something here. A lot of times I don't know what it is or who it is, but sometimes I do, and I felt her down here. I feel like she was a strong person that did a lot of things that and went through a lot of things that people just don't understand. You know, that was a harder life back then, and they relied on everything that they had. You could not be of a weak character and survive, you know. Mm-hmm. Family's always been a big thing for me, and my family, the people that came before me, are the reasons that I'm here doing this.
Are listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. For 10 years, beginning in 1969, Tony Hughes reported the weather on Twin Cities WTCN-TV, which is now Care 11. Like most TV weather reporters at the time, she was never an accredited meteorologist. But as a model and a dancer, she looked and sounded great on camera, and she raised viewership and ratings. Hiring Toni Hughes was a bold move for the time because she was African American, the first Black woman to appear regularly on weeknight newscasts in Minnesota. KFAI producer Allison Young brings us her story.
It's one small step for man, one
I happen to believe that women need to come forth much more forcefully at this juncture and assume a much more important role.
The year was 1969, a time in the United States of tremendous social upheaval. People of color were finally gaining equal rights, and women were joining the workforce in droves. And it was that same year, 1969, that a TV station in Minnesota, WTCN, was about to make history.
And the weather for it all, a little bit cooler, eh?
A little bit cooler, but it's not really too bad for the season of the year.
WTCN, which would later become Care 11, hired the first Black woman to join their news lineup in the state. And that woman's name was Toni Hughes.
She had an effervescent personality, and everything that she touched kind of drew people to her. And her being the first Black on-air talent in the Twin Cities was really a big, big deal at the time.
Toni's sister, Shirley Hughes, remembers well the beautiful, charismatic, and in her words, Renaissance woman who took to the air every weeknight for 10 years to read the weather to Minnesotans. Toni Hughes was a graduate of St. Kate's and worked as a nurse at the University of Minnesota School of Epidemiology, but she also had an artistic bent. Slender and graceful with a warm smile, she gigged as a model and a dancer. In fact, it was the founder of Minnesota Dance Theater, Lois Holton, who suggested Toni audition for the job of weather girl at WTCN.
It's interesting. She was a model, and she was a social model as well. Modeling in terms of being the first and being very aware of what she represented in terms of sort of carrying Black people, the Black community as well.
Toni's daughter, Roxanne Allen, reminds us that in those days, success was judged more on someone's look, their style, and their ability to connect with the viewer than any specific expertise. Even though Toni Hughes didn't have any training as a meteorologist, she took to her weather reporting quickly.
The Minnesota area snow flurries for the northern.
Now, this was a time before we had weather modeling or prediction tools like Doppler radar. So every weeknight, she would pull and review weather information from tear sheets fresh off a national wire. And she used this information to manually set up a rudimentary weather board. Over her tenure, Toni was at first separated on the set from the rest of the news team. Later, she sat with her co-hosts, gaining, quite literally, a seat at the table.
She went from a transition of weather girl to weather woman to weather reporter. So as the times changed, and remember, we need to think about the times in terms of women's rights, civil rights, technology was changing, news was changing, all of these things converged at the same time. But she grew as the times grew as well.
Toni Hughes' social influence was not limited to the Black community. She received fan mail from far and wide, including from curious out-of-staters with cabins in the Northland, wanting to keep a finger on the pulse of local weather. In July of 1976, Minneapolis TV Guide published an article called Two Minneapolis Newsrooms. A picture of WTCN's news team, including Toni Hughes, sits on one side, looking over at the cast of The Mary Tyler Moore Show. The caption underneath reads, "In the real one, they don't have to be funny once a week." Still, Roxanne points out that being the first woman and person of color on TV news put a tremendous amount of pressure on Toni to be as close to perfect as possible.
And my mom was always aware, and we were always aware as kids, of being on your best behavior, you know, giving your best presentation, because you just don't get second chances when you're a woman or a person of color, especially back then.
Even though Toni Hughes' position was prominent at a time of social change, she was considered a freelance contract employee, working only 3 hours each night and earning around $100 each week. All of this was happening while she was getting a divorce and raising two children as a single mom. By the late 70s, news stations around the country were battling it out for the number one slot. When WTCN transitioned to an NBC affiliate, it got caught up in the so-called news wars. Those in charge felt compelled to follow the trend of hiring a professional meteorologist to present the weather. Just a few months short of earning her American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, or AFTRA, credential, Toni Hughes was sent a two-sentence letter terminating her employment without severance or any offer to continue working at the station in another capacity.
But as I recall, she didn't dwell on that. She was the kind of person, okay, if this door is closing, then I've got to figure out some other doors to open up. What's the next chapter I've got to create?
In time, other doors did open, and she moved to San Francisco to become director of medical management at Cigna Healthcare. In 2000, Toni Hughes died of multiple myeloma. She was only 62. But her trailblazing career as the first Black on-air talent to regularly appear as part of a Minnesota weekday newscast made a mark.
I know that seeing my mom influenced other people to know that they too could be that. or more. We have come far. We've got farther to go. But we need to remember the people who sort of broke ground for us to get to where we are now.
So well said.
For KFAI, I'm Allison Young. You've been listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Support for Miniculture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on the KFAI website or go to kfai.org/MINNECULTURE.
And that is all for Miniculture Presents today. I've been your host, Michael Whetstone. You are listening to KFAI, Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, supported by generous listener members and